I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:22 p.m. Friday, January 28th, 2022. Members present, Representatives Kaufman, Nelson, Sponholz, and myself. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to do business. Thanks to our Secretary, Leah Frazier, and Moderator, Nate Williams. Please silence your cell phone, and if you're listening offline and testifying, announce yourself for the record. On the agenda today, we have a hearing, Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Thanks to Nolan Clauda, the Executive Director of the Center for Economic Development at the UAA Business Enterprise Institute, Mike Walsh, Vice President of Public Policy for the Foraker Group, and Lori Wolf, President and CEO of the Foraker Group, for their presentations today. So, Mr. Clauda, do you want to proceed with your testimony and slideshow?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Nolan Clauda, the Director of Alaska Center for Economic Development and for the Center for Economic Development, a program of the UAA Business Enterprise Institute. So on the next slide, please. What I want to be able to share with the committee today is a bit of an overview of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, you know, commonly just called the infrastructure law, the bipartisan infrastructure law. I started off putting together an analysis and a summary for a group of statewide economic developers that I convene each month, and it kind of blossomed from there into a lot of interest in hearing from what we had to say about the bill and what it contains. And so I'd like to give a pretty high level overview of what the bill, what the main categories of spending are, what some of the Alaska highlights are, and as well as some considerations for the state to think about as this, as the spending of the bill occurs roughly over the next 5 years. So, you know, it's kind of important to pinpoint and to talk a little bit about what the bill is and what it is not. And so, if you were tracking events during the pandemic, like CARES Act or ARPA, you know, they were very large bills that had a lot of different categories of spending and that were intended to be spent in a relatively short amount of time. So this bill is different in the sense that it's a 5-year bill. It's not intended to be stimulus, at least not in the traditional sense where, you know, we're trying to get the economy out of the slump, so we're stimulating the economy with spending. This is really not about that. And it's also doesn't contain COVID public health relief measures, does not contain social safety net spending, although the Democrats in Congress have been working on that reconciliation bill, the Build Back Better Act, but that's completely separate from this consideration. It doesn't contain business or nonprofit relief. Doesn't contain economic development funding of the conventional sort, not money for, you know, stimulating local economies or for economic development specific projects or stuff of that nature, like that the Economic Development Administration will typically fund. So, you know, with that out of the way, what the bill is, it truly is much more zeroed in on infrastructure and the major categories being transportation, you know, energy and grid, water, wastewater, broadband, and stuff that's adjacent to those areas. There's a lot of sensitivity given to resiliency of infrastructure, and that's a, you know, common buzzword, but resiliency in this case meaning that the ability of physical infrastructure to withstand natural disasters, climate change related impacts, and other kinds of impacts that might harm it in the long term or shorten its lifespan. Cybersecurity is also a consideration there as well. And although this is not a climate change specific bill like the other bill, it does have some sensitivities to climate change and to reduced emissions. The next slide, please, is the breakdown of the $550 billion spend in the bill. The overall amount of the bill, by the way, $550 billion, that is, you'll sometimes see a different number reported for it, sometimes $1.2 billion. And the $550 billion that we're talking about is the funding that's over and above other appropriations that had already occurred. So the bill authorizes more money technically, but the $550 billion is in this bill is what's new spending in terms of the federal budget. So about half of the bill, of that $550 billion, about almost $284 billion is transportation related. So I've got a breakdown of what that contains that I'll show in a moment. But broadband is the next biggest category at $65 billion, and these are the national numbers. Power and grid and energy related is $65 billion. Water, and that includes wastewater, $55 billion. Resiliency efforts at $47 billion. Legacy pollution cleanup, $21 billion, and then a special category for Western water for the more drought-sensitive states in the Western lower 48. The next slide, this is the breakdown within the transportation category of where the funding is going. So half the bill is transportation. The largest part of transportation is roads and bridges. You know, this is the bread and butter of what you would expect in an infrastructure bill. Highway funds and so forth. Rail is a large component at $66 billion. Transit as well. Airports for 25, ports and waterways at 17. Safety, also for ensuring the safety of other types of infrastructure. And then there's a couple of categories here at the lower end for electrification. So, for electrified ferries and buses are actually into one category. So for transit systems, especially, to switch from internal combustion to electric, and for a fair amount of money as well for electric vehicle charging for EV charging to build out that infrastructure, along with the highways. And then this reconnecting category, reconnecting communities category for areas where communities have been sort of torn apart often on racial or equity lines by the building of a highway through the middle of a city. And I don't know how much that is an issue in Alaska, but certainly in other places. In the next slide, a little bit about the design and the implementation of the bill. Spending here is spread over 5 years. And that is, I think, a good thing from a planning standpoint. The prior to stimulus-related bills and other stimulus-related efforts are often, hungry and searching for these shovel-ready projects, right, where all the preliminary work and permitting work and design work is already done, and we just need to start doing the construction. But in practice, projects like that where all the steps are done but they haven't been able to be constructed or they don't have the funding to be constructed are pretty rare. So a lot of the funding here is more patient in the sense that it recognizes that whole process of design, permitting, implementation, and so on to actually get built. So it's more about whether the project is good and whether it meets certain parameters rather than whether it's immediately actionable. So that's certainly a positive thing. The money is going to come in a variety of ways. There's a portion of it that I have a breakdown of this that is formula money that goes to, like other formula funds, goes to states in accordance to their population or to other factors, where all states get a certain allocation of the funding. And so a good portion of it is that there are also some direct spending that occur through agencies, operations, especially through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, where they spend money, in accordance to internal rulemaking processes within the agency. And then there are competitive grants as well. Some of the money will be let out through RFP processes with differing eligibility requirements, throughout, depending on what pot of money there is. There is a strong resiliency element to this, to the ability of infrastructure being built to withstand shocks. There's more emphasis on that than you would have seen in prior, infrastructure efforts or legislation. And there's also a little bit of room to try to be, attempts to be more innovative with the use of the funding. So pilot projects, research and development on infrastructure-related topics, looking for innovative solutions. There, some of that is for competitive grants or for looking for other kinds of solutions to deal with things like carbon capture and other related topics. So a little bit of kind of different thinking from that standpoint. Another point that's worth mentioning here is that that a lot of the work that's going to determine the specifics of this bill are going to be done through agency processes now that the legislation is done passed late last year. There are a lot of the agencies have to write the rules and the regulations that govern these programs, the RFPs and so forth, and in the bill a lot of those programs specify about a 120-day period or a 60-day period or differing lengths of time when those processes have to be done. So the spring and summer of this year is when we see a lot of those being more finalized and more firm as far as, you know, what the rules of the program are. On the next slide, just a quick note about in terms of, you know, economic perspective and historical perspective on this bill. You can see on the far right that orange line, that's the infrastructure bill. This is the projected, you know, the federal infrastructure spending as a percent of GDP, you know, as a share of the U.S. economy. And what you can see is that for the last couple of decades, you know, we've been relatively at the low ends nationally in terms of the amount of money invested in infrastructure. And this bill brings us up to a higher level than we've tended to see over the last few decades, although still lower than what you've seen in some periods in the past, especially in the 70s or, you know, during the New Deal in the 30s. But I think it still represents an important infrastructure investment that is more than we've seen in the last several years. I have heard questions before, and I get questions, you know, comments a lot on what's going on with the economy in general. And some folks have raised concerns like, is this bill going to fuel the inflation challenge that we see? And I don't believe that that's going to be a problem, because of the fact that the spending is spread over 5 years. It's not an enormous amount of money in the scale of the U.S. economy all at once, like the prior legislation was. So I don't believe that to be too much of a challenge, although there are some other economic challenges that I can get into a little bit in a moment. Next slide. These are the formula funds that we know are coming to Alaska. That were pretty much from the design of the legislation. We knew that these state formula programs, we knew how much roughly each state was going to get. This is, you know, by no means, don't think of this as all the money Alaska gets or most of the money Alaska gets, because there's tons of other pots of money, but the formula funds that we know are coming are largely listed right here. Largest share being federal highway aid, and the federal highway aid does include funds that can go to the Alaska Marine Highway System. Almost $400 million for airports. Large amount for water infrastructure. A lot of that is likely to be for rural communities. Public transportation, bridge repair and replacement for $225 million. Broadband for $100 million. That's an interesting one, because that $100 million is the floor. It's the minimum amount that a state can get based on population. But there's a lot of language in the bill that states can get more money for broadband if they're in low income or high need areas or areas that have very slow speeds. And Alaska is probably going to be very competitive on that because of the limited broadband infrastructure we have in a lot of the state, the very slow speeds, and the higher economic need that we see in large parts of the state, especially in rural Alaska. So Alaska is likely to get much more than that $100 million. There's the funding for electric vehicle charging, $52 million, wildlife protection, and cybersecurity. The cybersecurity is especially concerned with grid-related cybersecurity for the electrical system. Next slide. This is another key piece of info for what Alaska is getting is that the Denali Commission was funded to the tune of $75 million in the infrastructure bill. For reference, that's five or six times the typical annual appropriation that the Denali Commission is likely it usually gets in the last few years. So very significant funding for them. The commission, as you know, has a lot of discretion as to how they utilize their funding. Rural developments and rural infrastructure tend to be their focus historically, but they have a lot of latitude as a body to decide how to utilize that money. And I haven't heard specific announcements about plans for that just yet. Next slide. This was also known from the beginning of when the bill was passed, the marine transportation highlights. There's about $1 billion that go toward essential ferry service. And that was written in such a way that, that Alaska's ferry system is targeted by those funds. So that's likely, I don't know that all of that $1 billion, but I believe most of it is bound for Alaska ultimately. We're talking about a 5-year period here. $250 million for this electric or low emissions ferry pilot program. That was also written such that Alaska is one of the only places that would qualify for it. Construction of ferries and terminals there for $73 million. And then also there's some authorization for the use of federal highway funds for operation and repair of the marine highway system. There are a lot of folks out there that are more expert than I am at the marine highway system, but I don't have a tremendous amount of depth as to the use of any of that funding, but I did want to mention that, at least at a high level. Next, there were a couple of announcements from our congressional delegation about additional money, and this is mostly coming through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers part of the budget, for coastal and waterway-related infrastructure. This adds up to just shy of $1 billion worth of projects that are funded for construction. And that includes the largest one being the coastal storm damage reduction for Barrow. And then the Nome deep draft port for $250 million being announced. There's also funding for flood control and Seward, the Moose Creek Dam upgrades near North Pole, Kenai River coastal erosion, another important high profile one, the Denali Park Road, where the landslide cutoff access is also in there for repair. In the next slide, another important feature of the bill is the streamlining of the permitting processes. There's kind of two reform efforts, one from the Obama administration and one from the Trump administration, that this bill actually codifies and makes permanent both of them. The one federal decision policy in the Trump administration consolidated agency reviews, especially for environmental reviews, so that one single agency can make the determination for project approval. And then the other is the FAST 41 legislation that allows for greater departmental coordination on projects where a lot of projects where there's different federal departments have jurisdiction and it becomes complicated and cumbersome. But that process is designed to help with that. Also makes tribal and Alaska Native Corporation projects eligible for those streamlined processes. Sets a 2-year goal for permitting projects, and if you ever followed any construction or large project permitting, you know that 2 years is fast by those standards. On the next slide, mentioned some port and waterway funding. So what I'm kind of going through now, having mentioned the Alaska specific stuff, is the major programs that I think are worth highlighting from an Alaska perspective. None of what I'm talking about is exhaustive of the whole bill. It's 2,700 pages, contains a lot, but I have looked for highlights that are the most relevant to Alaska-related issues. So there is quite a bit of funding for port and infrastructure developments. This $2.25 billion, that's going to be through MARAD, the Maritime Administration under federal DOT, designed to fund a lot of port upgrades. A lot of language in there for port electrification as well, and I know that's been an issue, Southeast Alaska looking at electrified port infrastructure. And then a large amount of or some funding for remote and subsistence port construction, and that's again a federal piece, but I think that subsistence port, would tend to be especially important in Alaska. And then the Army Corps of Engineers resiliency, a whole package of things, and including some of those projects that were announced for Alaska,
Mr. Quill,
are linked to ports and waterways.
Can we do a question here from Rep. Sponholz?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Collada, for this presentation. What is a subsistence port? It's the first time I've heard
I don't recall, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Sponholz, I don't recall what the definition exactly is for a subsistence port, but it has to be a port or a harbor, that's heavily utilized for for local subsistence purposes. And I could probably see if I can locate a definition for you that goes beyond that. But that language, I believe, was emphasized by our congressional delegation in the crafting of the bill. So it does have Alaska in mind.
Yeah, it certainly does have Alaska in mind. I'm just trying to figure out which port it has in mind particularly. Thanks.
Thank you. And the next slide, slide 13, airports. There's $25 billion total in there for airports. What I'll point out is that a lot of the funding is labeled for non-primary airports. In other words, there was concern that LaGuardia Airport or LAX could, you know, easily consume $15 billion alone worth of capital expenditure. So the idea was to spread the money around to smaller airports around the country. So rural and smaller airports, are designed to capture the largest share of that funding. Next slide, please. For water, some important stuff here to point out. There's a lot of emphasis on revolving loan funds and for water quality issues, especially in light of some of the issues in the lower 48 with lead pipes or with the water situation in Flint and areas like that where disadvantaged communities have had poor water. So a lot of money is targeting those types of situations. A really huge one is that IHS, I've got it in bold here, but the Indian Health Service getting $3.5 billion for sanitation facilities. That is also something that was heavily pushed, especially by Senator Murkowski, if I'm not mistaken, that is designed for water, wastewater, and also solid waste facilities that benefit tribal communities around the country, but that will probably disproportionately be important in Alaska. There's also funding through EPA for water and wastewater operations too. Next slide. The broadband funding, this is something that's getting a lot of attention, and I think that hopefully solves some of the major challenges that we have in Alaska with cost and availability of high-speed internet. But as I mentioned, the minimum of $100 million per state, with additional money for underserved or high-cost areas. That's where Alaska, I think, is positioned to probably get a very sizable chunk of funding. There's also a lot of provision for states. You know, this money's going to go through the state, and then the state has the ability to provide subgrants to other entities within Alaska. There's funding for tribal specific funding, middle mile infrastructure, in other words, to connect a community that has like its last mile infrastructure to a broader system, so to build out some of the connections, and then also affordability vouchers, money that can go to households based on need to pay for internet services. On the next slide, the bill has some language specifically about the state broadband subgrants and what they can be used for. So those are for unserved areas, especially, and then they define underserved in terms of a certain upload download speed. Also for connecting anchor institutions that serve vulnerable populations. That can be community centers, libraries, health clinics. Infrastructure or low cost services to multifamily housing also. And then also for broadband adoption, like money for households to purchase devices. Or for institutions to buy devices to provide internet connectivity. So there's a lot here, and I think that there's more uses for potential subgrants than that. The next slide, the resilience funding. Big thing to point out here is that there's a lot of funding for flood mitigation assistance. And which is something that's a big challenge in some of the river communities in rural Alaska. And also that there is money for, there's tribal-specific funding here again, and for community relocation specifically, $130 million. And I don't know if there are communities in the lower 48 tribal communities that need to be relocated, but I think that we certainly know that there are here in Alaska, and a lot of communities that have spent years trying to get their community relocated because of flooding or erosion types of issues, especially. Next slide.
Mr. Quayle, could you pause for a second?
I apologize. Mr. Chairman, did you have a question?
Representative Kaufman had a question. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Clouda. The term resilience sometimes gets used in my neck of the woods on the South Anchorage hillside down the Girdwood with respect to fires, in populated areas. So where we have residential, forested and canyon terrain, hillside terrain that where we could have a bad fire. And I guess I'm wondering some of the mitigations for that or risk minimization is to assure ingress, egress, along with fuels reduction. So in this, I don't see under this description of resilience anything there. So where do you think those projects would fall?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, there is specific formula money for wildfire reduction. And it has in mind exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about where wildfire it threatens infrastructure, which it certainly does, and housing as well as the grid and many other pieces of infrastructure. So I don't know if that funding is going to live within the energy heading, or not related to, as a grid specific challenge, but wildfire mitigation is represented in the bill. And, I actually had it on that slide where I showed the formula funding, which is slide number 7. There is a $19 million worth of formula funding that we know of coming to Alaska that's specifically for wildfire protection. On the next slide, we're on slide 18, I believe. The grid resilience stuff that's listed here, concerns around the grid infrastructure in the U.S. often criticized as being a bit dated in some ways and has concerns with its ability to withstand outages and various kinds of shocks and challenges. So there are some competitive grants listed here, $5 billion for improvements to grid reliability. And also there's this other grant program that's a competitive one for new and innovative approaches to grid resilience, which states, tribes, local government, and public utilities would qualify. And also grid improvements for rural and remote areas, which they define as 10,000 or less. And there's $1 billion for that in the bill. On the next slide, just a couple more points here. There's a revolving loan fund for transmission line construction. Quite a bit of funding that's going into revolving loan funds in this bill that to make a lower cost capital for entities that are building, various kinds of infrastructure. And then there's some emphasis, some energy planning funds, especially for transmission planning, I think $500 million. Relatively small in the scheme of this budget, but also very important overall for planning purposes as far as deciding, how to build out infrastructure. And a lot of various grid projects get mentioned in Alaska to connect a lot of our islanded communities. The next slide, I'll mention that there's a good amount, a very hefty amount of weatherization funding. So the Weatherization Assistance Program, that generally it's existed for some time. This is just a large appropriation that's been given to that program that really expands what it can do. It's usually operated on a few hundred million a year nationally, and so now it's getting $3.5 billion, a lot of money. That in Alaska has most of those funds have tended to go through AHFC and then AHFC working with housing authorities and usually nonprofit organizations to improve, weatherization of residential facilities. So it looks like you can expect some expansion of that type of work. There is some funding as well for commercial retrofits and upgrades, and then a lot of funding that's going towards carbon capture, utilization, and storage, including a lot of research and development funding, probably stuff that would be of interest to some of the programs at the university, I would imagine, trying to figure out how to capture more carbon emissions and even to put captured carbon into products like building materials and concrete. So there's a lot of more sort of futuristic thinking involved there. The next slide, there's additional funding for some low emissions fuels. This bill overall is not doesn't have a ton of funding for renewable energy deployment. You can see that you know, $264 million, relatively small in the scheme of the bill. But there is some funding for nuclear to upgrade some of the large nuclear projects in the lower 48, but also for micro reactors, which is a very small scale next generation technology with improved safety and a lot of other features. And there's funding for that. And that is something that has been talked about a lot in Alaska. And Alaska is already going to be getting a pilot project, I believe, at Eielson Air Force Base with one of those systems. A lot of funding as well for hydrogen as a fuel source. $8 billion going toward hydrogen, towards these regional hubs to create and process hydrogen fuel. And that was something that I found interesting in this bill. Next slide. Supply chains for clean energy. The bill has some recognition that we've had these supply chain issues, especially related to critical minerals. Batteries and other kinds of products now require a lot of minerals that we often have to import from other countries, and that represents challenges for when there are supply chain problems, as well as various kinds of external shocks or security concerns. And so the bill puts some effort into the recycling and remanufacture of batteries so that some of the materials in them can be reused, and it funds some R&D to help with that. Also, it's something that I think is important for Alaska is critical mineral survey. This is money that I believe will go through the U.S. Geological Survey, if I'm not mistaken, to help identify sources of critical minerals, deposits in the ground. And in Alaska, you know, we have a lot of these. You know, we have cobalt in the northwest and rare earth elements in southeast Alaska. And so this is something that's designed to help spur the development of some of those resources. Next slide.
Sorry, Mr. Clouda.
Quick. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Clouda, Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to catch you off guard like that. Mr. Clouda, looking at the last one, so the mineral and the $329 million for critical mineral surveys, how much of that is going to be distributed amongst the lower 48 and specifically up to Alaska? Do you have a good knowledge of that?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, I don't unfortunately know how that's going to be broken down. That is definitely a national pot of money, and I don't have much awareness of where in the rest of the country the promising critical minerals are likely to be located. But what I do know is that Alaska already has a fair amount of promising prospects for critical minerals, and we're likely to get we're likely to get a significant portion of that. And I think it's important not just for the amount of money that it is, but for what kind of development might spur from it. And so I can't really speak to it beyond that, unfortunately. But I do know that a lot of promising potential has been identified in Alaska specifically.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Clouda, the permitting reform that we talked about earlier, does that have anything to do with some of the minerals or the mining operations that may have, or is there some permitting reform? Because up here, you know, as you know, it may take a while for a mine to go through the permitting restrictions that have been placed onto it.
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, I wish I could give you a better answer to that. I don't specifically know if the permitting reform is extending to natural resource projects or not. I wish I could give you an answer. I might be able to find that and get back to you. I believe that a lot of that permitting reform is in the transportation part of the bill, but I believe it's meant to apply to other kinds of projects beyond transportation. I'm just not sure specifically which ones.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
So, slide 23, the environment. There's habitat restoration, brownfield redevelopment for formerly industrial sites. But one very important piece to mention is that the legacy wells that are on the North Slope in the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska, the NPRA, that have been a problematic subject for a long time, where the federal government developed these natural gas and oil mines and then left them in the 40s and 50s, and they've leaked and caused other problems. Those are now in this bill. Agencies are instructed to actually clean those up finally. And so part of that $4.7 billion is to do that. I don't know how much of it is required to do that, but orphan wells are increasingly important subject. They leak a lot of methane. They cause a lot of environmental problems in the lower 48, and especially they have been kind of ignored for a while. So next slide, kind of closing in my last two slides here. I've spent some time looking at the analysis of the bill as far as what it's going to mean for state governments and local governments. And, you know, there are some issues that have been identified. None of what I'm talking about here is based on, specific knowledge of what, state agencies in Alaska are or are not doing. So I'm not trying to provide any sort of criticism or critiques. But major concerns, though, nonetheless, are what the organizational capacity is to run and to administer these various kinds of programs. You know, state government has declined in its headcount here in Alaska in the last few years. And these programs have a fair amount of complexity and will require a fair amount of administration, and that's something that's going to require some consideration. Luckily, it's over the 5-year period. That helps a bit, but there's going to be a lot of pots of money that have a lot of specific requirements and that require judicious use, and so organizational capacity is likely to be an issue for governments all over the country. There's also the issue of grant writer availability. That was something that Niels Andreasen from Alaska Municipal League mentioned in a meeting that I was part of, that local governments identify grant writers as a major gap. They don't have many of them around the state. There's also the concern of the money in this bill is mostly capital money. It doesn't provide for operations and maintenance. So that's always a concern with any kind of infrastructure, how you're going to operate and maintain it, and what funding is going to be available for that. There's the issue of matching funds. A lot of the money in here, all sorts of programs within this bill have all sorts of different requirements, but many of them do require a match. And so, so there has to be some in-state budget money allocated to that, likely through state capital budgets in order to get the maximum take. Also, another important point is about the coordination between different functions and different departments. So, you have money going through that's going to go through DOT. You have money that's likely to go through other departments. You have broadband money. You have road money. You have port money. And to get the most value out of that money, there's often going to be a need to coordinate projects. If you're tearing up the ground, to build a road, do you also have an opportunity to lay down some fiber or some wastewater infrastructure at the same time? And to do that requires a good amount of interagency coordination. And so this is something that government agencies in general aren't always, experienced at doing. Sometimes they are, sometimes they are not. Again, it's a generic comment, not anything specific to Alaska. Next slide, and this is my last slide. Couple of other considerations for this bill is that there are workforce shortages already happening, already with construction engineers, various kinds of skilled trades, various kinds of administrators, and this program is this infrastructure spending is going to create demand for all of those, right? So we have that issue to think about and to plan for. There's even one small detail hidden in the bill is that DOT projects, the federally funded projects, they are allowing local hiring preferences. So you could say an Alaska resident preference for those projects, and which is a good thing. A lot of projects in the past haven't allowed a local preference for hiring, but in Alaska we already suffer from a small labor pool, so it may be hard for us to maximize that and maximize our resident employment. Also, it's likely to push up the cost of some building materials and to make them a little bit shorter in supply because the whole country is going to be purchasing concrete and lumber and everything else at the same time. And that, have to account for a long lead time on some of these projects. There are some money that can go towards repairs or upgrading or deferred maintenance. That'll be spent a lot faster in our communities than than projects that require longer-term planning. And So the lead time is always a consideration as well. With that, My next slide is just a thank you slide. I would be happy to take any other questions, but I appreciate the opportunity to speak for the committee today.
Thanks, Mr. Clouda. That was a great presentation. We are going to have multiple hearings on infrastructure. I think it makes a lot of sense to sort of start with an overview. And this committee has an interesting purview because it's certainly workforce, but it's also just impact on competitiveness and economic growth potential for the private sector. So I guess that's how I see our committee's role. Obviously, this bill is big enough that all committees have a role. Are there additional questions for Mr. Clouda at this time? Okay, let's go on to the next presentation. I think from Mike Walsh with the Foraker Group. Mr. Walsh, are you there? You are.
Yes. So I'm on. Can folks hear me okay?
Please proceed. Yes, we do.
Okay. And just a, before get started, just a little bit of clarification. Are you going to move the slides, Chelsea? Okay. I'll keep you appraised of numbers. Thank you, co-chairs Sponholz and Fields, and members of the committee for allowing me to speak to you today about our economic reports. Our CEO, Lori Wolf, is unfortunately not able to join us. He's actually working closely with one of our partner organizations on some organizational development. But by title, I am Vice President of Public Policy at the 4-Acre Group, and we really appreciate the opportunity to share some of the data that is coming out of our just released, as of last week, report on the economic impact of the nonprofit sector on Alaska. Next slide. So many of you on the committee know quite a bit about the 4-Acre Group, but for those who don't, we are a nonprofit ourselves. We have a long history of service to the nonprofit sector, tribal organizations, and even state government, local government, and the federal government. Lots of different roles that we play. That slide really captures many of those. But overall, our job is really to strengthen nonprofit and tribal organizations in order to help them more effectively meet their very important missions. Next slide. So today I'm going to be presenting a bit of an overview of our work, and I've actually enlisted the help of Nolan Clouda to help with some of the details around our data analysis, because he's really up on that stuff. So he's going to be doing double duty today, and I really appreciate that, Nolan. But we're really grateful for the partnership that we've been able to have with the Center for Economic Development for many years. So, you know, I think our economic report is incredibly valuable, important, and accurate because of the work of Nolan and his team. We appreciate that partnership. But I also want to highlight that COVID really shows the importance of partnerships in a really broad sense. You know, we have partnered over the course of the last 2 years with so many organizations to first respond to and now to start recovering from COVID. And the center is certainly part of that, but we've got the Small Business Development Center. We've got the Alaska Municipal League. We've got many state departments, AFN. And just want to really highlight that partnership has been an incredible part of not only our response to COVID, but in building this capacity to present this really fantastic data. Next slide, please. So my job here is to introduce this report and some of the findings, and to hopefully highlight some of the things that might be of interest to the members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. So we really present six different ways in which nonprofits have a significant impact on the economy of Alaska. Nolan's going to talk in detail about each of them, but I just want to give some highlights that, you know, nonprofits are part of everyday life in Alaska. Many of us don't realize just how significant their connections are to nonprofits. Yeah, we think about food banks, we think about rescue missions, symphonies, Montessori schools, other environmental organizations, but we also don't often think of those that have other connections to us, like financial services, utilities, fire departments, public safety, veteran support. So that's one thing that Nolan's going to talk about. He's also going to talk about the fact that nonprofits are really a significant economic driver in Alaska's economy. We are connected and engaged with the economy through jobs, through payroll, through supplies, through purchasing of services. So there's going to be some really great discourse on that. We're also going to have some good discussions about our ability as nonprofits to leverage public funds for maximum return. You know, I know I'm demonstrating my age here when I say that I used to be a big fan of the $6 million man. You know, we can build in better, stronger, faster. I like to use that to say that when we're utilizing public funds, we do it better, cheaper, faster. So we are in a position to take those public funds and maximize our access to our earned revenue, to our donated dollars, for maximum return. So, you know, and for those of you in the field of economics, you know about the multiplier. So the multiplier, when we take that dollar, it actually turns into multiple dollars of impact. Nolan's going to spend a little bit of time talking about the role that nonprofits play as a partner with government in essential services. So that's a partner with government at local levels, state levels, and federal levels. You know, my background is in political science. I taught political science at UAF for a bunch of years. And, you know, I always hearken back to the Constitutional Convention that was held in Fairbanks on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus when our founder said, you know, we want a pretty small government. And that's what we have compared to other states in the nation. Part of that means that we don't have counties. In other states, counties are really big providers of some of these essential services, but our state really doesn't provide very much in terms of direct service. Those direct services, they are provided by nonprofits, and many of those have proven to be incredibly essential over the course of the last 2 years. Nolan's going to spend a little bit of time talking about the role of nonprofits in sort of energizing or being a catalyst for community investment and engagement. You know, good data about philanthropy, about volunteerism, about the role of a really engaged community, and just making our communities better places to live, to work, and to raise a family. And finally, no report on the status of the economy with respect to nonprofits would be complete at this time without some sort of mention of COVID. That, you know, the nonprofit sector has been a stabilizing force in the COVID economy. Nolan has done a lot of analysis of some pretty interesting data on job loss and the role in recovery and the stabilizing nature of nonprofit jobs and nonprofit programs and services. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nolan, who's going to walk you through some of our findings. Please feel free to ask questions. I use this term lovingly. He's the data geek. So he has some of the real, intricate or detailed information, but I'll also try to answer questions if I can. And so, Nolan, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. And I'll introduce myself into the record again, Mr. Chairman. Nolan Clouda, I direct the Center for Economic Development at the University of Alaska. So I on the next slide, some high-level information about the economic impact of nonprofits. So I know you get a double dose of me today on the committee, but our center worked very closely with the 4-Acre Group and with Lori Wolf to develop this report. We compiled and crunched a lot of the data that went into it and worked hand in hand with them in developing the report. So very intimately familiar with this, and I've already given this presentation before. So the nonprofit world, you know, I think we talk about the economic impacts in a couple of different ways. One of them is that nonprofits themselves employ a large number of Alaskans. And so you've got the number listed there, about 38,100 direct employees. And the true impact goes beyond that. But 38,000 employees is a significant number, greater than one person, one worker in 10. You know, at a nonprofit, 13% of all employment is with nonprofit organizations, and we also talk a little bit about the role of nonprofit employment in certain parts of Alaska, especially in rural communities where it approaches 50% or near that in a lot of cases, especially in rural western parts of the state and Arctic parts of the state. So on the next slide, touch on. This is the presentation sort of divided into the themes, and so I can state the theme and talk about the data behind it. So moving to the next slide, this theme's about nonprofits being the part of our everyday lives in Alaska and how that contributes to an economic foundation. This breaks down the nonprofits by class, you know, 501c3, C4, C6, and then there's a few other classes as well. The largest share of nonprofits are 501c3s that are considered charitable organizations. Of those, the biggest category are religious organizations, especially churches, as well as mosques or temples or synagogues or other kinds of religious entities, and education, human services, recreation, arts and culture. Down the line from there, you'll see that healthcare is near the bottom 6% or so of nonprofits, but a much larger share of employment and revenue. It's also worth noting that other types of nonprofits besides C3s, for instance, credit unions and utilities are also nonprofits, especially, you know, cooperatives like Chugach Electric, credit unions like Credit Union One or Alaska USA are nonprofit organizations. And then 501c6s includes chambers of commerce. C4s also includes various kinds of membership types of organizations too. Next slide. This was a piece to demonstrate how nonprofits are part of the everyday lives of individual residents that help to build basic needs and fill quality of life functions as well, ranging from healthcare to recreation and leisure and housing and food and workforce and education and energy. All of which are, you know, recognized parts of economic developments, you know, to tend to the foundational pieces, of quality of life and education and housing and basic needs. Next slide, and this is what gets into the really deep into the data part of the report. Nonprofits is a major economic driver. On slide 10, the next slide, this is where we really get into the meat of the nonprofit's economic impact on the economy in terms of employment overall. So, and something I want to mention also is that the State Department of Labor did a really excellent job helping to pull, you know, they using IRS information on nonprofit filings, matching that to the state employment number so that we could actually get the number of jobs that are at nonprofit organizations. Nonprofits are kind of hiding in a lot of the economic data because they're not broken out separately, but they helped us do this aggregation to figure this out. So the 38,000 direct jobs at nonprofits, that's in 2020, did a model that accounted for the fact that, you know, that nonprofit organizations also spend money buying services from businesses in the economy, and also that the payroll effects, you know, from employees of nonprofits and from the businesses that do business with them, you know, that the additional spending that happens at the household level from that create additional jobs. And so the total impact of all of that added up is about 58,000 jobs. Which is, you know, there's 300,000 jobs in the state of Alaska. So that's about about one job in five, about 20% of employment that's tied to nonprofits in some way. And the payroll affects a total of $4 billion, 2.8 of that is direct. For a frame of reference, I believe that the operating budget for the state has about a payroll of about $2.5 billion, right? So it shows you, you know, the state payroll is a huge driver in our economy, and nonprofit payroll is as well. Next slide, we compare the nonprofit sector to some of the state's larger industries. The nonprofit sector with about 58,000 jobs has about a comparable number to seafood, to the seafood industry, and in terms of all of those effects added up for both. Larger than mining by itself. You know, oil and gas is of course much larger, you know, but on the same kind of scale, on the same order of magnitude, I think, for nonprofits. Tourism, jobs haven't been counted, fully for a few years now, but they would be of a similar magnitude to the nonprofit jobs as well. And then, in terms of the overall economy, about 25% of all the non-government jobs in the state, if we just looked at private employment, about one in four jobs are tied to nonprofit organizations, and one in five of employment overall in the state. Next slide. I work in economic development, and so a perspective that I was able to help bring to the table with 4-Acre in this report is that, you know, in addition to those numbers and the jobs that are created by nonprofits, there's also an important role that they play as part of the structure and part of the foundation behind a lot of the state's leading industries. And so, you know, for example, if you take the resource development industries, oil and gas, mining, they are supported by a network of nonprofit organizations. You have your industry associations like AYOGA or like the Resource Development Council or Alaska Mining Association. You also have the various vendor supplier associations. You have oil spill removal organizations that are nonprofits, and you have various kinds of workforce development programming that supports them. And you have, with seafood, you have the aquaculture associations that run the hatcheries that enhance the salmon fishery. These are nonprofits. You also have our CDQ groups, right, that are their nonprofit organizations. You also have a couple of industries that are actually made up largely of nonprofit organizations, like finance. The credit union part of finance in Alaska, you know, banks and credit unions are nonprofits. The healthcare industry as well, over half of the employment there is nonprofits. Utilities are very over half nonprofit measured by employment, also telecommunications. And so all of these, you know, we kind of created this visual to kind of to show what that role looks like with nonprofits and major industries. The next slide, this is a map showing where nonprofits make up a large percent of the employment in each region. The highest percent is in the city and borough of Sitka, where it's about half of all jobs. But throughout areas like the Bethel Census area or the Dillingham area, Nome, Kotzebue, very high percent of the employment in those areas is with nonprofit organizations. You know, 20-30% in a lot of cases is with nonprofits. And so it, you know, it's pretty key to those areas' economies, the way that nonprofits flow. It's healthcare organizations as well as a lot of tribally affiliated entities. The next slide, this is in the 4-Acre report, in the impact report, but it's based on some work that we actually partnered with the 4-Acre group on a few years ago to look at the gender pay gap in the nonprofit sector as well as in the economy at large. And again, this is also something that depended on some data crunching that the Department of Labor did for us. But the gender pay gap from what we were able to tell from the overall economy in Alaska is that women make about 72 cents on the dollar compared to men, which is a pretty big gap, bigger than a lot of states. And then nonprofits actually have a little bit of a smaller gap, gender pay gap, 79 cents on the dollar, although it's still a very large gap. But one feature of the gender pay gap is that larger organizations, larger nonprofits, tend to pay more to their employees on average than smaller organizations do, but the gender pay gap between them tends to grow the larger the organization gets. So just one observation that we made from that. On the next slide, the breakdown of nonprofit jobs broken out by industry. About half of the nonprofit jobs are in healthcare. About 20,000 of those jobs, and then the other big categories, social services, which is what a lot of people think of when they think of nonprofit organizations. This category that's other, it includes some important organizations. This is where religious organizations and childcare centers are both sort of lumped and that's the next largest category for in terms of employment. You see that finance also ranks pretty high up there because of those credit unions especially. Next slide is looking at revenue for nonprofit organizations. We're able to use IRS data to figure out the revenue breakdown, total revenue by all nonprofits as well as some categories. Nonprofits brought in 2020 about $7.8 billion worth of revenue, very sizable chunk. About three quarters of that is with healthcare, especially, you know, large hospitals that are nonprofits account for a big chunk of that. But after that, human service organizations, education, and so on. And we can see that 501c3s are the biggest share of that revenue. Again, because of healthcare, most likely, but that 21% that goes to other classes, credit unions and utilities especially, that makes up a very notable share of that revenue as well. Next slide, talking about nonprofits leveraging public funds for maximum return. the next slide here on that one, on slide 18, is talking about the share of federal assistance dollars. This is a grant funding and other types of federal assistance that does also include loans too from the federal government. This was during the pandemic, so it was during 2020. A lot of money that was spread out from especially from the CARES Act in 2020 went directly to other governments, so federal government to state government and local government. So these are the types of organizations that received relief funding. Next category was to individuals, especially through those stimulus payments, and I think that some of the unemployment benefits may have been counted here too. For-profits got about $1.6 billion. You can see that nonprofits are only fourth on that list as far as receiving federal assistance dollars during the pandemic, which I think is interesting and noteworthy. There's often a perception that nonprofits are getting, you know, the largest share of grant funding or of assistance funding. The next slide is a little bit of information about the sources of revenue for nonprofit organizations. This is showing that earned income is actually the biggest category for nonprofits. About two-thirds of revenue that nonprofits get is earned income. A lot of that is probably healthcare because, you know, the insurance and federal or government payers for healthcare would all be considered fee for service. But the category that we don't love, but the IRS lumps together contributions and grants, so that would include donations as well as grants to nonprofit organizations. Mostly those would be distinctly important and separate categories, but the IRS breaks down the data like this, so that's kind of what we work with. And then a smaller slice of the revenue comes from things like gaming, like full tabs, from investments and from fundraising events. Next, about nonprofits partnering with government and delivering essential services on slide 21. On the next slide, we went through the data and we looked at nonprofits that were providing services that would more typically be provided by a unit of government, but that are provided by a nonprofit instead. Example of that, fire and emergency medical services. You know, this is usually a municipal government function or maybe a borough function, but a lot of Alaska is not within a borough or within an incorporated municipality. And so So quite a few places have to deal have volunteer fire departments or EMS services that are run through regional nonprofit organizations like I believe Cowerick in the Norton Sound area. They have their own EMS unit, right? And they're a nonprofit organization. So we counted 40 that are standalone and probably many more that weren't easy to identify in the data, but that are situations like Cowerick. Community library associations also that are nonprofit organizations, and then a huge number of utilities that are independent nonprofits as well, especially that are organized as co-ops in rural Alaska. So these are all examples of nonprofits that are providing services that might often be provided by a local government, but nonprofits are able to fill that gap at least to some extent. Next slide, a couple of slides that follow it about the COVID economy and the nonprofit role within it. On the following slide here, on slide 23, some surveying that was done actually with the help of the Alaska Small Business Development Center surveyed nonprofits to find out, ask how they were dealing with COVID, you know, during the pandemic, what kind of impacts it had. About 56% said a very significant impact on their ability to operate. 39% said moderate. And only 8% said, you know, that they had little or no impact. So there were obviously pretty heavy impacts. You know, the kinds of impacts of those that lost revenue, cancellation of major fundraising events, 57%, cancellation of performances, trainings, classes, contracts, associated loss of revenue, so earned income types of opportunities that had to be reduced, reduction in corporate giving or of sponsorships, 36%, and then reduction in individual donations. These were some of the things that nonprofits were reporting as far as COVID-related impacts. Next slide, we compared, we got the Department of Labor to pull nonprofit employment data for 2019 and for 2020 so that we could see where the losses occurred. Most of the nonprofit, of the sectors within the nonprofit world saw job losses, as most did in the economy as a whole. The biggest loss were in social services organizations, lost about 500 employees. Financial services actually cut back. That other category includes the religious organizations and daycares. At the other end of the spectrum, healthcare organizations actually added a few jobs in that time span. Early in the pandemic, a lot of healthcare entities actually lost jobs and then rebounded a bit later into 2020.
Mr. Clouda, we have a question from Rep. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Clouda, are you seeing a V-shaped recovery to some of these nonprofits that lost their jobs during 2020 and 2021, or is that more of a steady recovery back to it?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Nelson, you know, one unfortunate fact is that we have to have this data go through a custom aggregation. So it's this whole sort of process to get the data pulled. So we have the 2019 annual average and the 2020 annual average. And then we don't have any information after that. So we're not able to really specifically look at what growth occurred in 2021 and other time periods for the nonprofit sector specifically. I can tell you for the Alaska economy as a whole, we have seen, you know, recovery from, over the course of 2021. It has been a bit slower than the national average. Alaska's economy has been very slow to recover from the pandemic overall. Various reasons for that, probably a bit of a separate conversation. But for nonprofits, we don't specifically know how they fared in 2021 and 2022 yet.
Through the chair to Representative Nelson, just anecdotally, I mean, we don't have the verifiable data at this point, but just anecdotally, we're seeing nonprofits that are struggling with recovery from what's often referred to as the Great Resignation. So losing so many jobs, and while they're trying to recover and recovery is on the horizon, they are still facing, and you know, this is in all industries, really facing great difficulty in bringing new staff on board. So, you know, this isn't a scientific statement, but I think it's less of a V for sure. You know, it's a more gentle climb back.
Yeah.
Please proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, are we going to have a good idea of when those numbers will start coming in for 2021, 2022? Is there a general time frame when we're going to start getting reports back on that?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, we do these reports that 4-Acre does them about every 3 years, generally speaking, and so we request the custom aggregation from the Department of Labor. It requires a lot of work on their part, so it's done upon request, and we try not to put them through the ringer on doing it too often, because it has to fit into their workflow, and they have a lot of other things, but they've been very generous at helping us with that. So unfortunately, I don't know if we're planning on asking them between us and 4-Acre if we're going to have them do that aggregation for 2021 again and to look at the trends for nonprofits specifically. I'm not sure if there's a plan to do that or not. But I'll certainly watch the economy overall in terms of employment. I do, at least.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My final slide, and I'll hand things back to Mike. Slide 25. One interesting thing also about the nonprofits in the pandemic is that nonprofits were eligible for a lot of the relief funds that were, you know, labeled as more business relief. Nonprofits typically qualified for them. The biggest program, the Paycheck Protection Act, of course, created under the CARES Act. I crunched these numbers for looking at where, you know, what kinds of businesses around the state got the funding and how many nonprofits got funding. And only about 4% of the Paycheck Protection, forgivable loans went to nonprofit organizations. A very small percent went to nonprofits, even though they were eligible. And you can see here the largest category, other services. Biggest category there is actually religious organizations and some daycares. As well, were recipients of Paycheck Protection Program funds, but for the most part, nonprofits were less likely to get them. I mean, you can see there were still several hundred organizations that did, but that's out of 5,700 organizations total. Only several hundred that received funding. Not sure exactly why that is. It might be. These programs were designed more for businesses, and then nonprofits were kind of shoehorned into it. Might have been issues around marketing or awareness, or nonprofits were looking at other types of funds or programs that were better suited to their missions. Other factors like that. With that, I'm going to hand things back over to Micah, but I appreciate the time to the committee to listen to me twice today. So thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Nolan. And, it's funny. I always learn stuff when I listen to Nolan talking about this. I learned some things today that I didn't know this morning, when he gave a presentation to our partners. But next slide on 26, it's like, okay, great. What do we do with this? Okay. What comes next? Are there things that we can do together to really think about the issues and the policy that the House Labor and Commerce Committee is interested in, and we've got some suggestions, and they're on this sheet. Use this data. I mean, this is really good data that in many ways can inform solid policy discussions and ultimately pretty solid policy decisions. I mean, the information on wages and percentage of workforce and gender pay equity gap and the essential services portion. Use the stories. When you get a copy of this final report, and I promise that each of you will, we're still in development of the actual final copy. And when you get that, you're going to notice that there are some really fantastic stories in there that illustrate some of the important things that we're highlighting here. Stories of credit unions. And in fact, stories of one credit union, Credit Union One, which in fact was a significant sponsor of this research project, which we are very appreciative of. Stories of fire departments, of workforce development organizations. So I think you're going to be able to use those stories to sort of capture or to supplement that great data. We're encouraging you to utilize this information to sort of pursue policy that helps to further stabilize the safety net. We know full well that the safety net has performed a yeoman's duty over the course of the last 2 years, and really encourage you to think about how we can make sure that we're stabilizing that. Four, learning the lessons. We, you know, all of us have probably learned important lessons, things that we want to hold on to that we've learned in the pandemic, things that we need to let go of. But one of the things that I think we're learning during the pandemic is the importance of equity in public policy decisions. And so we encourage you to think about that focus on equity. And I know that you've had conversations in this committee, and we were pleased to testify last session on gender pay equity. Another thing is, don't leave nonprofit leaders out of discussions. So, you know, we can provide some really great information, insight, to help as you're developing good policy solutions. So bring us in the table. We're really ready, willing, and able to participate. And finally, you know, just think about as you're reading this report and thinking about your own lives, because each of us has different connections to the nonprofit sector. Just think about recognizing in some meaningful way the work of nonprofits in your day-to-day life, but maybe in particular as part of this response to the global pandemic, which it's not over. There's still much work to do, but the role of the nonprofit sector in recovery is going to be significant. Next slide. And use this really interactive tool. I'm not with share capability right now, but that link at the top of that page is going to take you to our webpage. And I know we've been able to share this with a couple of folks around the table already, but it's a really neat, brand new, fantastic, interactive part of our report where you can actually look at a lot of different things. Some examples there, number of nonprofits, nonprofit share of total wages, the, you know, things on philanthropy, and look at your particular census area. Okay. And so I think this is going to be, a fantastic resource for each of you as you're thinking about not only that kind of policy that affects the entire state, but those that really have an impact on your particular area. So I would encourage you to check that out. And with that, we really very much appreciate your time today. I know we've done a lot of talking at you, but are there questions, thoughts, insights that are going to help you in your policy conversations? And Nolan and I, depending on what the kind of question is, we're ready, willing, and able to answer them.
Additional questions? Not at this time. Thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation.
And thank you again for the invitation.
Okay, that wraps up our business today. Our next meeting will be Monday, January 31st, following the Department of Revenue subcommittee. And we'll take up the CSHB 159, consider amendments, and hopefully be able to take action on that bill. Thanks again to our secretary today, Leah Frazier, and moderator Nate Williams. At 4:40, we're adjourned.